Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
CHLY 105.5 Radio Basics. We back for another week, hitting you up every Monday, 8 to 9 p.m. I'm here with my brother comrade, Justin.
Yo, what's going on, everybody?
Oh, my mic wasn't on, was it? What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Radio Basics.
And we're up in here with our assistant comrade, Alex. She doesn't have a mic, though. What's up?
Hi, everybody.
Hey. So we got a big show for you tonight, but more importantly, we are amidst the 2009 annual fundraising drive here at CHRY 105.5. It is called a sound investment because investing in your community radio station is a sound investment.
It's the best thing you can do.
As you know, I mean, we rep in community media, right? We're Basics, Radio Basics, yeah. The radio wing of Basics Free Community Newsletter. And we can't do what we do without the support of community radio, which allows us to come on here and air the news and views of the people.
Yeah, we're very antagonistic to corporate interests.
That's right. So, you know, whether it's in the cultural scene or whether it's in the, the political sphere, you know, we know that the major media monopolies control, for the most part, the airwaves, the print media, but we're trying to change that up in here.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a big show for you tonight. Our feature interview is with Tom Workman. Justin, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Tom Workman has just recently come out with a book about the history of working people since 1970 and the transformation of working conditions, decline in wages, the decline in unionization. I'll let him explain it more, but Workman has put out an amazing book.
We also have some other news headlines and. And also, we're going to be asking you all throughout the show to please call in 416-736-5656. Call CHRY and make your pledge, make your donation to CHRY. We really can't stay in the airs without the continued ongoing support of the community. You support us. We support you. We are one. We are the people, man. Call us. Support us. Make a pledge. $10, $25, $50, $100, whatever you can do. It's definitely a sound investment. Jumping right into our headlines, federal labor news, what is the future of pensions in Canada? Pensioners, the long-term disabled, and now former Nortel employees are declaring that they want justice and action from the federal government to overhaul the country's unfair bankruptcy laws. This coming Wednesday, October 21st at 12 noon, workers from across Canada, especially from the union CAW, the Canadian Auto Workers Union, Energy and Paperworkers Union, Steelworkers and Teamsters, will unite to protest the bankruptcy laws in this country that privilege the interests of banks over workers. Protests will be held at Queen's Park in Toronto and Parliament Hill in Ottawa, amongst other sites across the country. At issue is the loss of pensions, severance pay, disability, and medical benefits as many Canadian companies, like Nortel, go into bankruptcy. Their message is that workers who helped build successful companies are being discriminated against, cheated out of what is owed to them, and now they face financial ruin. Pension insecurity is a problem for millions of Canadians who lost their savings in the financial crisis, and tens of thousands with private pension plans are facing disaster. Wednesday's rally, once again at Queen's Park, will highlight the 17,500 Nortel pensioners who are now watching their former company being sold off to pay off creditors while they face cuts of up to 30% in their retirement incomes. Because in a capitalist society, banks come before the interests of workers. This is just absolutely absurd.
But it is crazy, and it's happening all over. I mean, just in The Economist a few weeks ago, a lot of CEOs were getting together and saying workers got to get over the sense of entitlement, that they're somehow entitled to a secure retirement. They need to get beyond that and work harder and be more productive and such and such. But, you know, there's definitely a war going on against people just trying to have a decent quality of life, you know, when they retire.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was in Europe over the summer, and while I was there, I had heard that French workers at a Nortel plant, amongst actually some other plants, it was some direct action carried out by workers at a Nortel plant, you know, was encouraged by, and then in turn ignited many other workers to do the same. What they did was they actually threatened to blow up their buildings, yeah, blow up the workplace, yeah, because they were denied severance packages. And I believe in a lot of cases the French workers who had taken direct action at the workplaces with their unions not taking any action over the denial of what was rightfully theirs, a lot of these workers actually got the concessions.
Yeah.
But Canadian workers are not getting that. Now, what the unions are calling for is federal action. Not too sure what that's going to mean, what that's going to translate into. But if the unions are only proposing that this federal action, you know, be limited to the socialization of the costs of these pensions, right? So which is to say that the Canadian government step in and actually pay for all the security and the pension of the pensioners, which is, I mean, the pensioners absolutely, you know, they need the security. They deserve it. They work for it, of course. However, what the issue that's really not being raised is why the banks and why the companies are not taking a cut of the losses as well. Why are the banks first in line? Justin, I know you have a better analysis of this.
Who
gets paid in bankruptcy protection?
Well, what happens is a worker is classified as an unsecured creditor, meaning that they are owed money, but they come after banks, after suppliers, like, say, a company they haven't fulfilled their contract with for, say, raw materials or something. Mm-hmm. And they basically, they're the last priority. And if, you know, let's say you don't have a union, an individual worker is going to have to dip into his own pocket and, you know, fight the corporate lawyers and secure something for themselves. But
which is pretty much not going to happen in...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can one person take on Walmart, especially with a Walmart salary, right? And, you know, even if you do have a union, at best, you're not going to get what you're fully entitled to. In the United States and Britain, they have programs to ensure maybe you can receive a portion, maybe $50,000, but you can't expect to retire on $50,000, can you?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Moving on to other news, Alex Thompson has some news from us from the University of Toronto.
Yeah, so some of our listeners may know about the transitional year program at the University of Toronto. Thanks. And it came to my attention actually just recently, about a week ago, that the University of Toronto administration is pretty much putting into effect some administrative changes, what they're calling an administrative transfer, that will pretty much lead to the end of the transitional year program. And for those who don't know what the transitional year program is, it's a program at the University of Toronto that provides access for people who haven't been able to follow like the traditional sequence of events in terms of getting into university. So maybe they haven't finished high school, or they have had some sort of a life experience that's made it difficult for them to enter universities. The transitional year program is a program that adds on an initial year to your university studies and allows people from usually marginalized communities and from marginalized experiences to enter the university and then the academy, which is a space, a very privileged space within our societies, right? So the University of Toronto is now, after 40 years of having this program at the university, putting in measures that will pretty much annihilate it. So this is
the exclusion of you know, working class people from university,
from universities,
mm-hmm, from access.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a little bit from a letter that the Transitional Year Program Preservation Alliance, it's like a call out that they've put out to the community, because they need support from community members, mm-hmm, to approach the Faculty of Arts and Science, to approach Woodsworth, which is the college that the program will be assimilated into, to say that we don't want TYP to just be sucked up into the university structure and eventually disappear, because there are a lot of things about the structure and the way that it's organized now that allow it to operate in the amazing way that it does, even though there are serious limitations. So I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts. So they say, the challenges that TYP faces are clear funding and prioritization. Access and equity has not been made a priority by the central administration. Unreplaced faculty retirements combined with budget cuts have endangered the program, and the proposal in front of you does not contain any solutions to these real and immediate challenges. What is being proposed is an administrative move and not a solution to these problems. In fact, we see more problems on the horizon if this proposal were to pass. And then they give a list of problems that I'm not going to read through because it's a long, long list. But they end up by saying that TYP services the most marginalized communities in Toronto, provides access to high-quality university education to members of these communities. The changes TYP alumni have made to the city are immeasurable. Many minority educators, business owners, social workers, and many other marginalized professionals got their start at TYP. So, today, at 3 o'clock, there was a rally outside of the Arts and Science, the Governing Council, offices, just to build awareness and to show the administration that people are opposed to the changes that will be taking place, that they have planned for the program. Some people, well, obviously you're hearing it now, so you weren't able to go, but this Wednesday at 4:30, from 4:30 to 6 at Woodsworth College Council, which is at the Woodsworth Residence at St. George and Bloor, 321 St. George, they will be voting on the actual changes, so we need people to come out to show their support for this program. If you are interested in quality education, then please come out and show your support, because this is a program that we can't really afford to use. You can get in contact with the Preservation Alliance at tpa.access@gmail.com.
Okay. Thanks for nothing, U of T.
Yeah, really.
Except my degree. No.
Which is precisely why we need you to fund community radio. I don't know.
It all links somehow.
It all. No, because
no,
you know what?
Does.
This is not getting talked about in the mainstream media, right? It's not being given the play that it deserves. And people need to fight back, which is why we need community media to promote and propagate the information that we're doing. Mm-hmm. This is a sound investment. This is running from October 14th to 24th, CHRY 105.5. We work because the people support us, because the people work. This is community radio, so please call in right now, 416-736-5656. Make your donation, make your pledge. This is how we operate. We're going to be going to a commercial, CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice. The world's only 12-hour strong man on the air. Here on We Love Radio, 108 FM. The last on your dial, but first in your heart. And that's the truth.
Finally, summer's here after the cold season. Stroll in the park and walk the long route for no reason. And then Esplanade, young boys plaguing the fool. Kids pass the day away, plaguing in the waiting pool. I was a child too of 10 years old. Dark skin, always slim, quiet, peering out my window. Always the loner, rarely felt alone. Was an old soul, I was told, but I was barely grown. But when I wrote, I felt so at home. Poems inside the rhythm pen tapping at my collarbone. And though it's true I held a little fame, always felt like I was not the same. Teased, they call me names. I was not accepted, wasn't unexpected. Before dark skin was in, often felt rejected. But still sat in the sun, soaking in its rays. Daydreaming, breathing in the sweet scent of lemonade. But somehow I never felt afraid. Trying to conquer my fears while my peers fought but obeyed. It's like the world is going insane. A young boy shot in my neighborhood, rest in peace, Jermaine. Behind my building where I used to play, in the alleyway in broad day, down the block from Market Lane. Caught was so vague in what our mission is. No wonder most of our leaders, they got visionless. So the violence is tooth for tooth, hand to hand, eye for eye, face the truth of a wasted youth, far from how the world used to be, acting like we didn't live the same lives. And it's new to me.
That was Toronto's own Ian Kamau. That was Dear Summer off the September 9 mixtape. Ian Kamau is a member of Esplanade. Sorry, not a member. He's a resident. Grew up in Esplanade, and people, if you're from Esplanade and you are interested in community organizing work going on down there, you should check out the Esplanade Community Organization, which is some Basics members are involved in. Alex, you're involved in that too, no?
Yes, I am.
So, anyways, this is a sound investment. This is CHRY's annual fundraising drive. And if we're going to be able to keep on the airwaves, people, you got to give us a call. Please make a pledge, make a donation to Radio Basics, the program, and to CHRY. This is how we survive. Justin, take it away with our feature interview, brother. Oh, yeah. By the way, you got to call 416-736-5656.
Yeah, that's right.
Program that number into your head, into your phone, 416-736-5656. You can pledge to Radio Basics anytime throughout the fundraising drive, which goes up to October 24th. But please call in now and give us your support. Justin, what do you got?
Okay, so I'm going to just read a quote here just to contextualize a little bit. Quote, "The pageant of humanity in the age of capitalism has been an illimitable web of misery. If we let the apologists define the present, if we let them pretend that things like rising unemployment, deepening poverty, the destruction of workers' lives, feckless corporate corruption, bloated capital markets, and so forth are associated with, quote, crisis, rather than with capitalism itself, then we have done a terrible disservice to working people everywhere." This is an excerpt of our guest today, Thomas, of a book from our guest today, Thomas Workman. Professor Workman is in the political science department at the University of New Brunswick. His new book, If You're in My Way, I'm Walking, attempts, quite masterfully I might add, to conceptualize the situation of working peoples in Canada since 1970. Workman joins us from New Brunswick today. Hi, Professor, and thank you for being here. Professor?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so Professor, can you explain the title of your book and what it symbolizes for workers?
Yes. The title of the book is taken from an event, a real event, in 1996 that came to be known as the Shawinigan Handshake. And what it was a protester was in Hull, and he was telling the Prime Minister, as the Prime Minister was walking along a sidewalk as part of an official function, that he should be unemployed. He was yelling at him, shouting, as were a number of people, "Chrétien au chômage, you should be unemployed." And Chrétien grabbed the protester in anger. It was investigated, and subsequently no charges were laid. But it was came to be known as the Shawinigan Handshake. And the next day, Chrétien boasted to the media, "Some people are in my way, and if you're in my way, I'm walking." So we thought that that might be a good title for the book, since it kind of caught the condescending and patronizing attitude that many political officials have towards protesters who have been trying to fight against the globalization and fight against neoliberal policies.
Mm-hmm. So you begin your book with a historical section tracing the post-war development of the material conditions of workers.
Yes.
Which you sharply divide in the early 1970s. Can you elaborate on exactly why things changed in the 1970s?
Yes. Well, basically, prior to that, in the post-war period, which is kind of the era of our grandparents, there is a confidence in things, in the sense that people thought that wages were always going to continue to rise, and that social programs would continue to be strengthened, and so on. And indeed, even into the early 70s, we saw wages continuing to rise. And we even saw a strengthening, for example, of the unemployment insurance regime. But what happened is, in the late 1960s, there was in many sectors of global capital, there was a sharp decline in the rate of profitability. And once that set in motion, once that extended to all sectors of the economy and to all regions of the world, there was a concerted effort to begin to scale back these gains that working people had made in the early post-war period. So by the time the 70s are moving along, and you're getting into the late 70s, early 80s, you're really starting to see the effects of this redoubled effort to drive down wages and basically scale back social programs.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things that our grandparents, say, took for granted, like pensions, unemployment insurance, social programs, they're slowly being phased out to return profitability back to corporations.
Well, in the end, it's about restoring rates of profitability, yes. Mm-hmm. Rates of profitability are always hard in a capitalist system to sustain and maintain.
Right.
So therefore, any agreement or any kind of social compact that is drawn between working people and the leaders of industry are bound to be fragile. I say in the book that the compact was scratched in sand, not etched in stone, mm-hmm. Signifying that once the rollback begins, the rollback can begin in earnest on every front.
Right. So chapter two then, entitled Conceptions of Working Life and Labor Laws, you write, quote, "The conditions of working people has been deteriorating, and this deterioration is a central goal of the neoliberal accumulation project." Can you explain the deterioration and why it's a central goal?
Yes. Well, basically, what you have to do in order to scale back wages is among other things, attack organized labor and unions. So to that end, a few things have been done that have been noticed by several commentators. And one of the most salient strategies has been to actually get people to think of themselves differently in the workplace. And this is kind of summarized by the idea of once thinking about ourselves as workers in a factory and now thinking about ourselves as associates, for example, mm-hmm. working at a retail store or a retail outlet. So you change this notion of working life so that people come to be much more suspicious or much more deeply suspicious of unions than they ever were in the past. The underlying message is that workers who are organized is somehow not appropriate to the new economy or to the post-capitalist economy, as it is sometimes called. And to that very same end, labor laws have been reformed in two directions. One, there's a general strategy to make it more difficult for workers to unionize and to make it more difficult for workers to actually strike and go on strike and exercise their kind of collective power. And at the same time, labor laws have been deregulated and stripped down so that workers who are in non-unionized facilities basically will remain in non-unionized facilities. And both of these strategies, changing conceptions of work and scaling back labor laws, really have the ultimate purpose of trying to drive down wages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm thinking of the example of in the early 80s when interest rates were jacked up through the roof, 18% or something like that. And, you know, you had massive business failures, which was essentially workers were let go, fired, and union membership declined.
Yes.
Sucking away their union dues.
Yes. Well, yes. Well, unions have been attacked in a number of different ways. But in the end, the effect has been very clear that rates of unionization have been falling. And when we say rates of unionization, or what is sometimes called union density, what is meant by that is just the number of workers who are unionized when measured against the overall number of workers in an economy. And that rate has been falling. It's fallen several percentage points in every province and across the country generally. And when that is happening, it means that workers are obviously either less able to organize or fearful that if they do organize, a company will suddenly bolt on them or shut up operations. And this happens just enough so that all workers are kind of reminded of this reality. Of course, in Canada and more generally across North America, you have the creation of the Rust Belt, which threw really the fear of God into workers.
Mm-hmm.
So those developments actually in the economy directly, as well as the change of labor laws, and the shifting the kind of promotion of the idea that unions themselves were antiquated and very unnecessarily conflictual institutions have all kind of contributed to this decline in rates of unionization. Even though the number of unionized workers has generally continued to rise, it hasn't risen as fast as the increase in the overall workforce. The effects of that, of course, are very have become over time very clear. The incidence of strikes fell sharply in the last 20 to 25 years, in some provinces by over 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the other thing, which was the ultimate goal of everything, is that real wages started to stagnate. And it's telling that real wages rose more in the 1930s, that is the decade of the Great Depression, than they have risen in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And it might attest to the contradictory nature of capitalism that at the same time they're trying to stimulate the economy, they're trying to roll back wages.
Yes. What you do is you create what some people call a recessionary psyche. So that even though the economy might be doing well by more traditional measures, such as growth and so on,
mm-hmm.
you create this sense that bad news can be just around the corner. Or that bad news for a particular firm could be just around the corner. And it's just enough to create a hesitation in working people so that they, for example, don't join a union or don't agitate to form a union, or, again, that they don't strike even if they are unionized. And so you create what some would call a climate of fear, what others might even call economic terrorism.
Mm-hmm. No, that's an excellent way of putting it. Professor, can you explain what you call the low-wage sphere, and how does this sphere explain what is happening to current employment relations?
Yes. Well, the low-wage sphere is a name that is attached to the wages in the economy that are very close to the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few things about this sphere that is noteworthy. First of all, it tends to always be in the non-unionized sectors of the economy.
Right.
But the thing that's noteworthy is that the workers in this sphere, about 25% of all wage earners in Canada, in fact, are within about $3 of the minimum wage. And that picture worsens significantly when we just look at women. Even though the number of female workers in the Canadian economy is comparable, roughly equal to the number of male workers, far more women actually hover closer to the minimum wage than do their male counterparts. So that in the Canadian context, about 25% of all female workers are within about $2.25 of the minimum wage. And in some provinces, the picture is absolutely, utterly bleak. In Newfoundland, for example, about 25% of all female wage earners are within about 60 cents of the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that women are in the economy in equal numbers as their male counterparts and yet hover much closer to the minimum wage shows that a significant aspect or dimension of this low-wage sphere is the fact that women are being kind of corralled into the worst jobs, the worst-paying jobs of the economy. And that is not inconsistent with what we tend to see in the global economy, where women are often in the lowest paying spheres.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And I know even one stat that always catches my eye is females with a PhD usually earn, 10 to 15,000 less than male counterparts.
Yes, that's right. Those kinds of ramifications don't stop merely in the low wage sphere. That's for sure.
Oh. Professor, can you talk about the persistence of joblessness in Canada, and what is your take on the gutting of unemployment programs in Canada, and specifically maybe the EI program as it
is
today?
Yes, I'd be glad to. What is strange about that, or curious, is that this was one of the signature achievements for the labor movement, especially as they fought for it in the 1920s and 30s. The call for unemployment relief was one of the primary goals of the labor movement. So when this was implemented in the Canadian context in the early 1940s, it was and by the way, when the government did that, it was in the middle of a war, so it kind of did it as a bit of a cash grab because it knew it wouldn't be making very many payouts in the middle of a war. But when they did finally implement it, it was an achievement for labor.
Mm-hmm.
And the program was strengthened fairly consistently and expanded, and the coverage was extended to women. And by the early 1970s, you had coverage that was acceptable. About 80% of the people, of workers who found themselves unemployed, were able to avail themselves of POGI, of the old unemployment insurance system. And this was quite an achievement in many respects. It didn't give them a permanent alternative to paid employment, but it gave them latitude. and it gave them some time to be able to look for a better job and so on. But what happened is, even though unemployment persisted for the next 30 years, there was a kind of earnest attack on the unemployment insurance system, which gathered momentum through studies and so on, and the McDonald Commission in the 1980s. And by the time that you arrive at the 1990s, there's now a full-fledged political assault on the various aspects of the program. So even though there's a persistence of unemployment, as we saw in the recession in the early 80s and the recession in the early 90s, the unemployment insurance system itself was gutted. So that by the time you get to the late 1990s, even though you see rises in unemployment at times, you'll still see a continual, you'll still see a fall in the number of people that are actually receiving unemployment insurance. And this was the first time that, that this happened, where you'd have a rise in unemployment and a fall in the number of UI recipients. Mm-hmm. And it's a deliberate strategy. It's a strategy that makes it makes people more desperate. It makes them move away from towns that might have relied on seasonal employment, or it makes them move to another region of the country, or it makes them take a crappier job because they simply can't get POGI relief.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Now, with the attack on unemployment programs and low wages and stagnant wages and declining unionization, as much as this is an attack by the state and by, you know, the business classes, it's also a fault of the left in terms of mobilizing. Can you just explain that? Because I know that is the basis of your last chapter.
Yeah, well, the argument is that the left has not been able to parry neoliberalism very well. Mm-hmm. These policies that we've been talking about generally are referred to as neoliberal policies. The state has basically been setting an agenda that is the agenda, the preferred agenda of capital, and particularly what's sometimes called transnational capital or the large transnational corporations. Mm-hmm. It's their agenda, and the state has been setting that agenda, and the left has reacted to that agenda by kind of arguing that, for example, cuts to social programs shouldn't be made, or that rather than being weakened, the unemployment insurance system should be strengthened, and so on. The left was probably destined to run into this kind of a problem insofar as it felt that the post-war era was a kind of permanent arrangement, and one that couldn't be rolled back. And it really was nonplussed or frustrated or really not sure what to do collectively once it was confronted with this assault. And the assault really, as I said, began in the 1970s, and there was nothing that the left could do. It has long since abandoned any sense of working class discourse. The NDP has tended to not really resist the neoliberal agenda with much strength. Organized labor has been back on its heels, owing in part to factory closures as well as declining rates of unionization and so on. And all of this kind of combines to create a real gap where the left has been reduced to individual organizations, very admirable ones, that are fighting kind of specific policies. In the Toronto area, for example, there's the Wonderful Workers Action Center that has taken up the cause of workers who are really being kind of abused in the low-wage end of things. And these organizations exist across the country, but there's no galvanizing left movement that's been able to kind of withstand the neoliberal onslaught. And it's unlikely, sadly, that even is going to happen until there is a real reinvention of the left. Sometimes it is said that the economic downturn that began in the late, the latter part of last year, 2008, would result in a New Deal. And what is missing from that optimism is the fact that when the New Deal was forged in the 1930s, it was forged with the presence of a very vital left. And at that time, alternatives to capitalism were on the table. No such thing exists today. And whatever comes out of the efforts right now being made to come up with a new set of arrangements, particularly on the regulatory end of finance capital, labor will simply be left out, and the left will be left out, because its voice has just been eclipsed by circumstances in the last 40 years.
No, absolutely. And, you know, your point on the NDP, I can remember about a year ago, when the election was happening, Jack Layton promising balanced budgets.
Yes.
In the midst of a recession, or what was going to be a very bad recession, which, and even his support of the conservative government just recently. and confidence motions.
I think that the NDP, a recent delegate to the NDP convention in Halifax said that there's no more left-right in Canada. It's all about good management. And I thought, well, that's honest. That's exactly what that sums up the NDP's abandonment of the working class quite well.
Mm-hmm. Professor, finally, do you see anything promising, anywhere in Canada, movements or, maybe even certain politicians or parties emerging?
I don't think there's anything promising in the sense of will there be a quick response to the current crisis. The current crisis, which is arguably 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years old, depending on how you measure it.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly isn't only a year old. But there won't be any response to the current crisis that will be meaningful. But what I think will happen, and what I hope will happen, is that the inability to respond will expose the weaknesses of the left and create a long and earnest revisitation of the left's basic orientation. And I would hope that much of that orientation would be centered around the question of capitalism itself, so that we don't tend to see the crisis as just a little hiccup along the way, but we tend to see things like poverty and unemployment as being necessarily rooted in the very nature of capitalism itself, and the need to respond directly to that. So whatever left is kind of reborn as the failures of the left become exposed in the upcoming years, I certainly hope that this question of capitalism itself is once again put on the agenda, as it was in the 1920s and 30s.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Professor, and that goes back to the quote that we mentioned from your book, that, all these problems are associated with crisis because we're letting the apologists define the present and not ourselves.
Yes, that's right. The left needs to say that it's a crisis rooted in the system. It's not a crisis just rooted in bad decisions along the way.
Yeah, or improper regulation.
Or improper regulation, exactly. Yes.
Professor, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
The book is If You're In My Way, I'm Walking, available, I believe, on Fernwood Publishing?
Fernwood Books out of Halifax, yes.
Right. And it's a great book. I only got it on reserve today for 2 hours, and I had to give it back, but...
Okay.
I was actually amazed. Congratulations. It's quite the accomplishment.
Thank you very much.
Okay. See you.
Bye now.
CHRY 105.5. This is Radio Basics. And as Tom Workman said, the left has been decimated. Mm-hmm. And this is suggested by the complete lack of any organized response to the most devastating crisis for the working class. A crisis ultimately in capitalism, right? That is devastating the working class because those the effects of the crisis is being passed on to us.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing was to bail out the lenders, to bail out the banks, and not the mm-hmm. people that whose houses were being swept away from them and their jobs as well, right? And
so this is why Basics, Radio Basics, and all the organizations we work with, this is why we are proponents of community organization, okay. Solid mass organization amongst our amongst the people, amongst our class, amongst the working class, and amongst our allies. Because without organization, there's no talk of an reemergence of a left, of any political force that will represent us. We have to represent ourselves. We have to organize ourselves. And in the context of that, we need community media.
Mm-hmm.
We need radio stations like CHRY, like we need newspapers like Basics Free Community Newsletter. So please call in right now. We are broadcasting to you right now from CHRY 105.5 amidst a sound investment. This is the annual fundraising drive of CHRY 105.5. You can call in and make a pledge, make a donation. Please do what you can. Give what you can. $5, $10, $15, $25, $100, whatever you can do. The number is 416-736-5656.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're listening out there, pull your money out of that stock market because that is not a good investment, as you can see.
You're going to lose it anyway.
You're going to lose it. You're for sure going to lose it. So, send it over our way because we can definitely use it.
And look at those workplaces that are unionized. We have companies right now where they're going into bankruptcy production, and the first people that are being paid off are the creditors, the large creditors, the banks. And even with unions, working class people can't fight back against the fact that they're being denied severance, their pensions are losing massive amounts of money that we can't even fight back within our unions. So, and I mean, obviously that has a lot to do with the fact that the structure of the unions and who's leading those unions.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not to get rid of unions, it's to strengthen them. It's to strengthen the participation of rank and file members in those unions. And if necessary, to overthrow old unions and to create new ones, whatever may be necessary.
Well, yeah, it was after the Great Depression that they started forming bigger industrial unions to match the growth of capitalism, right? You couldn't just have your small little craft unions. You needed more solidarity, and that's the way unions have to move themselves.
This is also why, you know, radical unions like IWW, International Industrial Workers of the World, came together to fight for workers unemployed and employed. Those are unionized, those are not unionized, especially because big unions were very close at that time in that period of history with the industrial relations and with the government. So, CHRY 105.5, please give us a call. It's a sound investment for you to make a pledge, make a donation. 416-736-5656. That's 416-736-5656. Call in, make your pledge to Radio Basics and CHRY 105.5 FM. We're going to go to commercial. We'll be right back.
Massive, massive. This is GT Taylor, the dancehall master from Reggae Radio, Irie FM, Ocherius, Jamaica. Say, keep it locked on 105.5 CHRY Radio.
CHRY 105.5. Radio Basics, we're back. This is a sound investment, CHRY 105.5's annual fundraising drive. Give us a shout. Make your pledge. Make a donation. The number is 416-736-5656. 416-736-5656. Radio Basics, we got a couple news headlines left for you before the show goes out. But before that, we got a track.
Yeah, by Toronto artist Keith Buttle. And if you know you're an artist out there and you got some tracks, make a pledge and maybe you can get on our radio program at some point.
But even if you don't make
it's a sliding scale, but I'm just trying to rack up some money for this wonderful station. So this is Keith Buttle, Beautiful World.
CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics, we're back, and this is a sound investment. This is CHRY's annual fundraising drive, so please give us a call, make your pledge. This is how community radio works. The people support us, we support the people. We get out the news, the views, the artists, the tracks, the independent labels and artists. We get that out there because we're community radio. We're not commercial radio. We're not corporate radio. We're not monopoly media radio. So give us a shout. Make your pledge. It's 416-736-5656.
Yep.
736-5656. Give us a shout. And final news headlines for the day. Justin.
Current York West councillor Giorgio Mammoliti has declared his candidacy for mayor of Toronto in 2010.
Boo! Enemy of the people.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Mammoliti was part of the Legislative Assembly of Ontario from 1990 to 1995 with the NDP, and he was also head of the Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 767, but don't be confused. Mammoliti is less concerned with, you know, left-wing politics and the marginalized people of Toronto. Mammoliti led a coalition opposed to the NDP's Bill 167, his own party's bill, to extend special benefits to same-sex couples. Local activists called his speeches in the legislature hateful and discriminatory.
You know, Mammoliti holds the privilege of... Are you covering this already? You got it?
Hold on. I just got
to... All right.
Stories of Mammoliti, and then we'll go after that. Mammoliti once took his shirt off during a debate in government to protest nude beaches in Toronto.
Protest?
Yeah, he was protesting the nude beaches, and he took his shirt off.
Saying, nobody wants to see this type of thing?
I guess so. I don't know. That's just part of, the profound inability for spontaneous thinking, I think, that Mammoliti possesses. snap judgments are definitely reactionary and far too close-minded, I'd say, to, you know, deal with the diversity of people in the city of Toronto.
Yeah, you know, Mammoliti has the distinction and the privilege of being one of a few people to date who have been named official enemy of the people by Basics Free Community Newsletter. And we don't just give this distinction to blundering idiots, even if that is what he is. But Mammoliti is a dangerous man. Yeah. This is the same individual who, the same city councilor of Toronto, who claim that we need the army to occupy Toronto neighborhoods in order to deal with the problem of horizontal violence in our communities, in order to deal with gang violence. This is the man who said that we need to bring in the army. This is the same man who, and you can check out the Basic story. I think this is when we named him enemy of the people. This is the same man who sent, who was an apologist for the police going into a small business up in his ward, One Love, which was a small, I believe, Caribbean business, and I believe it was on Wilson, but I don't have the exact details. You can check out the Basics article. The police went in, raided this business, beat the living, whatever it was living out of the business owner, and then when Mammoliti was questioned about the behavior of the police in his ward, he said that in responding to accusations of racism, he said that this is not true, this is not racism. We beat up, or I've justified beating up people of all backgrounds or races or something like that. So this is potentially our future mayoral candidate, Giorgio Mammoliti. Check out Enemy of the People at basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, and you can read all about our future mayoral candidate.
I can
potential.
Just imagine him having control over the police budget, and like,
which is already at $1 billion a year, right?
Something
and rising,
which is like the fifth largest police budget in North America. Mm-hmm. Like, how many people? Like, in the last couple of weeks, I've seen cops doing, like, standing around doing nothing. So many times.
Yeah.
Like at the mall, at the movie theater, at Starbucks,
at
you know what I mean?
It's like,
you know what I mean? I saw eight cops sitting at Starbucks, sitting around doing nothing.
They can afford their $8 coffee.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is where our $1 billion is going, of City of Toronto residents. Although, you know, we're being milked for our tax dollars being put into places that we do not need. What we do need is you to support community radio.
Wouldn't Mammoliti, because I know Mel Lastman called in the army to shovel snow. Does he have the power, if he is mayor, to...
I don't know.
To do it? He might.
He might.
But if you can get him in to shovel snow.
I can get him in to stop people from killing each other.
And I mean,
gangs in Toronto don't exactly. I don't think so.
They don't exactly wear uniforms, right? So who are you going to police? You're going to police.
Well, let's just look at the way, you know, and I'm sure the police have better intelligence than the army does on Toronto's communities. Let's look what happened when happens when raids happen on working class communities in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of youth get swept up.
Yeah.
It's a big blitz in the media that, you know, there's a massive raid on, on, you know, drug dealers and whatnot, on gangs in communities. And then what we're not told is usually that 95%, 98% of those people, sometimes, in some cases, most, like almost everybody, is released
with no charges, nothing to hold against them.
But
so
yet
you have like little children being held up at gunpoint at 3 o'clock in the morning because you're trying to find someone who's not even there and doesn't exist.
Stormtroopers like running in and smashing.
For real. And what's left in the mind of the public is images of 150 young black men being herded into police vans.
Custody.
That image stays forever.
Yeah.
You know, not the fact that most of those kids were released the next day, the fact that most of them are innocent, they never did anything. That doesn't stick in the mind of the people. What sticks in the mind of the people is that there is a genuine threat in our city, which doesn't exist. And it's not, it's far more inflated. I mean, there is a problem of horizontal violence that we got to deal with in our communities, but it's up to the communities to deal with those, not the army and not certainly not the police.
I think the problem is, you know, the 24-hour newsreel. You can always turn on the TV and see the news and you know, you see an image of crime and then you just assume it's happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same story from yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Our final headline for tonight in cultural news, but I suppose you can also include this as an international news item as well. This coming weekend on Saturday, October 24th, the Philippine Solidarity Organizing Group, which is affiliated with BASICS, will be organizing a solidarity fundraiser for the victims of typhoons Ondoy and Parma in the Philippines at Not My Dog, which is a bar, 1510 Queen Street West, just west of Lansdowne, with the main musical act being Hot Carl and the Cincinnati Bowties, as well as other musical guests.
What a name.
Yeah. People should go look up what that name means exactly. I thought it was a really cool name. But
I see a band with that name.
Google that and find out what those terms mean. But nonetheless, I'm sure they're a great band. I've heard they're a great band. I haven't listened to their music personally. But just to give some background to this, Typhoon Kitsana struck the Philippines on September 28th, bringing massive damage, pouring a month's worth of rain in just like 6 to 8 hours, inundating metropolitan Manila and the nearby provinces with water sometimes reaching depths of 20 feet. Kitsana killed almost 250 people and affected 4.4 million. Just days later, the Philippines' northeastern Luzon provinces were hit by Typhoon Parma, the second storm, which landed on October 3rd and which has caused major landslides, leaving more than 300 dead, has affected 2.5 million people in the region. And 500,000 people have been displaced by the back-to-back storms. Meanwhile, the corrupt and fascistic pro-U.S. government of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo in the Philippines has exploited the calamities in order to justify, check this, the military intervention of hundreds of American soldiers who were stationed at their Japanese permanent base in Okinawa, Japan. On October 5th, two U.S. warships docked at Manila, docked at the harbor in Manila under the pretext of humanitarian intervention. An unknown number of American troops currently occupy the Philippines under the so-called Visiting Forces Agreement. On September 14th, evidence of direct U.S. involvement in military operations within the Philippines was revealed when two U.S. soldiers were killed when their vehicle was ambushed. In response to the deaths, the Pentagon declared, check this, that the soldiers were part of the forces waging the so-called Operation Enduring Freedom, or the U.S. Global War of Terror, of which the Philippines was declared one of its fronts in 2001. A lot of people don't know that Philippines is actually a front of the so-called War on Terror, which is really a war of terror. Since the late 1960s in the Philippines, the society has been in a state of civil war, with increasingly large tracts of rural areas of the archipelago in a state of rebellion and war against the government. And increasingly large mass movements in the cities calling for the overthrow of the corrupt and brutal Arroyo government. In response to the intervention of American troops, the Communist Party of the Philippines, one of the leading organizations behind the current People's War and the large rebellion, wrote in a statement in early October that this is an outright violation of Philippine sovereignty. If the intention is really to assist in relief operations, why not send instead unconditional aid and support from non-military personnel and civilian agencies, as other countries are doing? The deployment of U.S. troops supposedly to assist in the relief efforts here aims to cosmeticize the presence of U.S. interventionist military forces and counter the growing clamor for the abrogation of the Visiting Forces Agreement and other unequal treaties. And so I suppose that this is why the Philippine Solidarity Organizing Group is organizing this solidarity fundraiser, so that the victims of the typhoons get the funds and aid directly, rather than through the agencies of the extremely corrupt government. So again, that solidarity event will be held on Saturday, October 24th at the bar Not My Dog, 1510 Queen Street West. That's just west of Lansdowne. And again, the musical act for the evening will be Hot Carl and the Cincinnati Bowties, as well as other musical guests. Remember, people, this is solidarity, not charity. This is people-to-people work, not dependency-inducing service agencies and international NGOs and corrupt governments distributing, you know, rotten food aid that big agricultural businesses couldn't sell anyway. But this is people-to-people solidarity. And this is also what we're calling for with a sound investment. We're calling for solidarity. We're calling for the communities that are listening to our the airwaves right now, who plug into CHRY, who tune in, who like our programming, like the fact that we're playing incredible and independent music, a lot of artists that you won't hear in the mainstream, in the corporate monopoly media. The fact that you're hearing the news and views from people's struggles from close to home and around the world, but what's really going on with the economic crisis, this is because we are community radio. We need your support. Call in right now, pledge, make a donation. The number is 416-736-5656.
Yeah, please definitely call in. And I'd like to thank Tom Workman for on and sharing, you know, his views. And you know, he has a wonderful book, Fernwood Publishing. That's Tom Workman. The book's called If You're in My Way, I'm Walking. I got a track, if that's cool with you, Steve. It's going to go out to, you know, the struggles in the Philippines and, you know, the unfortunate event of that typhoon. It's called Down in the Flood by Bob Dylan and the band. So, and then so, I guess we're done. So that's it for
another week of Radio Basics.
Yeah.
We're here every Monday, as you all know, 8 to 9 p.m., or if you don't already know. Also, please check out our blog. We have a new website coming up, but for now, we still got the blog. It's basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. You can check out all the regular news features and analyses that we put out, as well as notices of upcoming events. And once again, please call in. We need your support. We need you to pledge. That's 416-736-5656. We can't do it without you people. Much love. We're Radio Basics. I'm Steve.
I'm Justin.
I'm Alex sometimes.
Much respect.
See you guys.
Yes. All right. Radio Basics. We out.
Au 21e siècle, l'homme invisible d'Ellison existe. Le préjudice demeure, persiste et puis signe. La résistance n'est plus dès qu'on s'y résigne. Et l'amnésie collective s'installe tranquille. La haine dans ce monde est basée sur des faits vécus. L'histoire se répète chaque fois qu'on dit jamais plus. Les cœurs s'assèchent comme un désert où il n'a jamais plu. Où les vautours rapacent qui étaient restés à l'affût. Il y a ceux qui ne connaîtront jamais l'aube de la fin. Pour d'autres, la fin du monde arrive chaque matin. Leur quotidien est aigre, doux comme le sucre de la canne. Et la misère dans la main maigre qui la coupe d'une hache. Ainsi va la vie qui va, ce n'est pas d'elle qu'on se cache. On prend notre place sur la scène et pas dans les coulisses. Même si on se dirige tout droit vers le précipice, à chaque jour on le lit sur la page front du